Multiple suitors say they want to buy JEA. The demo of the Jacksonville Landing gets underway, but another downtown site is getting a facelift. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. We'll be back up over the air later this afternoon. In the meantime, listen to our live stream at wjct.org/listen as we discuss the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can call us up. Already getting your calls? It's 549-2937 to join us. Then later in the hour, a conversation with Trombone Shorty about his upcoming show at the Amp. Don't miss that. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss yet another very busy week in the news, we welcome Giorgio Valentino of Folio Weekly. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record.
Good morning, Melissa.
And journalist and author, Nikisha Williams.
Hey, everybody.
Good to have you guys all here, and there's so much to talk about this week, beginning with downtown development and downtown demolitions. But we're going to kick things off with JEA, no surprise. We all learned this week that the publicly owned utility is entertaining offers from 16 different private players. This includes Florida Power and Light, Duke Energy, and Emera, among others, we've learned. All of this despite the fact that selling off JEA to the highest bidder remains a very unpopular idea around town, both with the public and increasingly a growing number of members of the city council. What are your thoughts about this? We want your calls. It's 549-2937 to join us. And by the way, it's Public Power Week. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open as well. All right. Let's begin with Giorgio Valentino. Folio Weekly has been writing quite a bit about JEA and the privatization push. We learned about 16 companies interested in buying the utility, and these were sealed bids, all done under a shroud of secrecy, although now JEA is saying they're going to open the process up somewhat.
Yeah, well, first of all, this underscores the importance of voting, because this wouldn't be happening if the mayor had been reelected and emboldened by 16% of eligible voters. So keep that in mind as we go into next year, which is a big national election. And, you know, if you want the world you live in to be a good world, you got to vote. But now, things being what they are, I see a very difficult path ahead for the basically unanimous majority of people who don't want this to happen. But, you know, they seem to be going forward with it, like you said, under a shroud of secrecy. And privatization in general is sort of the worst of both worlds. You got a lot of opacity. You got the taxpayer seems to be set up to pick up the liabilities and all the risks, whereas certain people are going to make a lot of money in the private sector.
You know, Nikisha, it is Public Power Week, but the utility has officially left the Florida Municipal Electric Association. The TU reports this comes after the trade group questioned some of the financial assumptions JEA CEO has been touting to promote privatization. At the same time, the leader of the First Amendment Foundation in Florida, Barbara Peterson, said she has never seen anything as twisted as the JEA sale process. And so a growing chorus of criticism from multiple different players around the sale of this utility.
I think the stink on this sale is just starting to reach to the high heavens, if I can be cliche for a moment. From the moment that word got out that there was possible political maneuvering by the mayor's office and by JEA to sell a public utility that nobody really had any specific issues with, it was a mess. And as the process has continued with the leaving of one CEO, bringing in another CEO that was close to the mayor's campaign and close to the political machine, and then the entire process of, oh, we're going to put it on the ballot. No, we're not going to put it on the ballot. We're going to form a task force by city council to look at the issues and to evaluate the process. Oh, no, we're not going to do that anymore. Oh, we're going to leave the public utility and we're just going to go this process alone. I think people are really starting to realize that it's another one of those issues in the city where the mayor gets what he wants no matter what and no matter what the political costs. And as Giorgio mentioned with the lack of people who went to vote in the past election, this is what he wanted to do and now he's doing it because he can and nobody's there to stop him.
Mike Mendenhall, will the city council go along with the privatization of JEA? A growing number of members on that 19-member body are pushing back, realizing what a huge vote this could be. This is probably the biggest vote they would ever take.
Yeah, and I think some of the city council members are starting to realize that this could be the issue that really gets pushed back from voters in the long run. And here, council members Randy DeFore and Brenda Priestley Jackson have really come out as strong opponents of this and have really been, you know, kind of putting their weight behind their opposition. But you're also starting to see calls for from other council members as well who wouldn't typically go against the Curry administration. There has been a call even for an independent audit from the City Council Auditor's Office on JEA's financials, which the council auditor's office is independent. They don't answer to anyone. So that it would really give a non-biased look at JEA's claims of financial instability.
It's 549-2937. You can call us and join the show as we work to fix our technical difficulties as we stream at wjct.org/listen. What are your thoughts about JEA's privatization push moving ahead? 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. We're getting some of those. I'll get to them in a moment. Meantime, Giorgio, St. Johns County is now saying it might consider buying JEA utilities within the St. Johns County boundaries. A new wrinkle in this whole mega story.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of developments. Nobody knows exactly how the final process is going to look, although it seems that, I mean, decisions have already been made that are being executed now, and they've been in the process of being executed for some time. And the mayor's had general counsel come out and say things. I mean, they always kind of position things in advance, line everything up, and then go for the kill.
Mm-hmm. What about the First Amendment Foundation looking into this whole process? Calling it twisted, calling it a travesty of open government. Could that have any real impact?
I mean, I think it's just going to add to the chorus of growing opposition. It's just it's one. I think it's one more piece of that will put pressure on the JEA administration, JEA board to maybe open up a little bit more as the process unfolds.
And go ahead, Nikisha.
I just don't feel like criticism really bothers the administration and the executive office. I think it's another layer of the story, and it's another way to try to pressure a more open process. But since for the last, what, it's been, what, about 10 months, almost a year, that this has kind of been in the works, it's still full steam ahead, and it's only picking up speed no matter who says what. That maybe we should slow it down. Maybe we should look at it a different way. Is this really necessary right now? Should we put it to a vote? None of that has slowed down the process of this going forward. And even though even the CEO saying that this is a cloaked process, they are defending and even become more defiant in their position about why they want to go forward with this, no matter who's calling them out.
Let's talk about the other side of this, the argument that the city could get a windfall of anywhere between $7 to $11 billion if JEA is sold off. Critics have said that that might be a way to fix the city's unfunded pension liability issue. I'll read a few tweets about that in a moment. But Giorgio, you know, the city council, as they weigh this and seek their own legal advice, they ultimately would hold the cards. And theoretically, at least, they are supposed to put this before the public, a referendum, before more than 10% of JEA is sold.
Yeah, and we know how city government here is about referenda. I mean, and speaking of the school board referendum, I mean, what's happening now is part of a pattern of behavior that basically everything that the mayor's done since re-election has been deeply unpopular, and they just say, damn the torpedoes, we're just going to go ahead and do it.
Let's go to your calls now. We are streaming at wjct.org/listen this morning while our transmitter's being repaired. Give us a call, 549-2937. Jerome is in San Marco. Hey, Jerome. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, Melissa.
Sure.
You know, I'm completely and utterly opposed to this JEA sale without the permission of the ownership, which is, as I understand it, the citizens of Jacksonville. But I do want to tell you about a recent development in San Marco. See, we're taking bids on Lenny's house, and you can go, that's Lenny Curry. Just go to www.lennyshouseforsale.com and enter your bid. See, we're going to sell his house without his permission, and then we'll come back and ask him how he likes it after we've sold the house. That's kind of what they're doing here. And obviously it's the parody, but what, I mean, just the whole sham of this is beyond comprehension. And I guess it's Jacksonville, so maybe we should start comprehending it. But I think you know how I feel. I believe you could have a poll on this every day for the next 2 or 3 months, and you're going to find that 90% or more of the citizens of this city have no interest in selling JEA. So why they are pursuing this path is really a big mystery. And once again, thank you. And I'm listening to you online using my desktop computer this morning.
Thank you, Jerome, for listening. A little humor from Jerome. We can joke about this stuff. But at the same time, I think he is conveying, guys, an overwhelming sense among the public that this process, that there is something not right about this process. That is the narrative, anyway, that we are hearing from the public, from good government watchdogs, and from our listeners. Here's just a few tweets. Adrian tweets the show, why the lack of transparency? Why are they building a new headquarters if they're selling? How will we know who the buyers are? Here is another tweet. I'm scrolling through many of them from our listeners, and we thank you for sticking with us as we stream online this morning. John tweets the show, the mayor's real reason for privatizing JEA is a rush fire sale of our city's greatest asset is to get cash to cover up the city's unfunded pension death spiral that his failed policy caused, so he can finish out his term and leave City Hall before the city pension debt hits. Of course, the mayor would disagree with that, and he is an open invitation to appear on this program. He has been on several times. And it would be interesting to get his take on all of this. But what about that comment, Mike Mendenhall?
Well, you know, you're kind of going back to the headquarters. I mean, you have a developer too that has already invested a lot of money in producing this headquarters. They recently extended JEA's deadline to opt out of the lease. So Ryan Companies US would actually own the building and JEA would lease it. But if JEA opts out, Ryan's going to have to make a decision. Do we move forward with this $72 million building and have to try to find, you know, Class A office tenants? Yeah, I mean, and that's a big decision that they're going to have to make. And, you know, so that's an investment and deal. And that's also something to watch, too. You know, if JEA opts out of that lease, that mm-hmm. could show that there's
Nikisha.
It's a mess. It's just an utter and complete mess. It's like there's pushback on the sale by the city and the public and several big organizations and people that speak out against it. But then there's also like this like trying to maneuver to sell it to the public and say, well, hey, we put them in a big shiny new building near the courthouse. They'll have upgraded facilities to better serve you and do whatever they need to do. And if we sell the utility, we'll get all of this money to handle the pension debt or go towards repairing the schools or whatever it is. But there has been no concrete plan of what's going to happen. It's just been like, hey, why don't we sell JEA? Let's see what that will do. And there has been nothing presented to the public as, okay, this is why it would be expedient to sell JEA. This is what we will do with the money. And this is how it will help the city of Jacksonville.
I think that, Georgia, that's why there's so much consternation among the public and some public officials. This perception that this is being done in smoke-filled rooms, to use an old cliche, that the case hasn't been publicly laid out for the public to digest and weigh in on as to why it might be a good idea to do this and what it would gain for the city of Jacksonville. Here's a tweet for Dave. This is from Dave. This is like those vulture capital firms that sell off all assets while running the business into the ground and looting the company by paying themselves ridiculous salaries and consulting fees, all right before our eyes, because there is nothing anyone can do to stop them.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it is. And, you know, privatization generally is it can be a short-term boon for certain stakeholders, and then for everyone else they're left kind of holding the bag. And that's what everyone is worried about here. And I mean, that is exactly what's going to happen.
Here's a tweet from Valerie. If the JEA SLT was serious about innovation, why haven't they presented any recommendations to the Charter Revision Commission to change the charter? Was selling Jacksonville's greatest asset the only option for innovation? Theoretically, the charter could be changed to prevent a public referendum on this, although all parties involved have denied that that would be occurring. At the same time, some listeners have pointed out to us that in other parts of the nation, communities that have private power are looking to move back to public power. For example, out west, customers of PG&E, I can't find the tweet, but someone sent it to me last night, pointed out that people are dealing with brownouts and big rate hikes. So there's this fear, Mike, that privatization could lead to something like that in this community. Although, to be fair, Florida Power and Light, let's assume they would be the eventual buyer, they have a good customer service reputation.
Well, it all depends on who's running the utility. It depends on the administration. It depends on the quality of their workers, and you know, and that's something that that the folks of Jacksonville would lose control over if there's privatization. There are some private power companies throughout the country that do a decent job, that do have good customer satisfaction ratings, but again, a lot of it depends on the management. You know, and going back to the charter change too, the city council could technically change the charter with a two-thirds supermajority vote. The question is would they think that it's politically expedient to do that? Mm-hmm. And that's a question that we still don't have an answer to.
Right. And how much pressure, this comes down to a few members of the city council. How much pressure will they feel from City Hall, the executive side of City Hall, as opposed to their constituents?
Well, I mean, they're hearing from their constituents right now. Whether they want to listen, that's up to them. But I think on an issue this big, there will be consequences if they don't listen to their constituents. So that's a risk they're going to have to take.
Okay, and if you're just tuning in, by the way, you can stream us right now at wjct.org/listen while we fix some technical problems, and we appreciate your patience as we work on that. We are taking your calls, emails, and tweets. Keep those tweets coming as we discuss the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable here this morning. With us, Giorgio Valentino of Folio Weekly, journalist Nakisha Williams, Mike Mendenhall of The Daily Record, and myself. 549-2937. Call us up. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. We're going to move on and discuss some other big notes and news from the week. You may have noticed that there are big changes happening downtown as a demolition crew has started to finally tear down the Jacksonville Landing. Yes, despite much hue and cry over that, another controversial decision, the city is moving ahead and they are taking proposals for what might eventually replace the downtown icon. Now, at the same time, the city is taking some heat for the crumbling Riverwalk. Gaping holes along the walkway along the St. John's River have become something of a safety hazard. Let's begin with the landing. Mike Mendenhall, the Jax Daily Record has followed this from start to finish. It's finally coming down.
Yeah, so they've actually been doing a lot of what they're calling deconstructing inside even since late August. They've subcontracted with Eco Relics, which is a local salvaging company, and they've been taking out memorabilia and all those sorts of things before they start. But they did file for their permit to demolish the actual landing itself earlier this week, and so they're going to do a phased demo. Demolition, starting with the buildings on the back end, moving toward that main building. And they actually, the one business that was still operating in there, the BBVA Bank, is now gone. So they're, we don't know if there's going to be a change to that phased demolition. It could come down faster now that they don't have to work around an existing business.
This was another controversial move by the mayor. This one, unlike JEA, which had, overwhelming pushback, when you talk about the Jacksonville Landing, That seemed to be an issue that was a little bit more evenly split among the public, people that agreed with the demolition and people that were really appalled by it. Nikisha, you know, this is something that, at least according to the very unscientific feedback we've gotten from our listeners, people tended to split a little bit as to whether this was a good idea.
And I think that just has to do with some of the nostalgia of the people that live here. The mayor had made it no secret about his ire for the Jacksonville Landing as a crumbling landmark and, you know, prime real estate property that you could do something better with. I remember when I first moved to Jacksonville almost 9 years ago now, the Landing had a Banana Republic and a Nine West and all these businesses where you would like to go to shop, but there was no real draw to go when Town Center was booming. And I think that's kind of just the story of downtown Jacksonville in a nutshell, that there's no real draw to come downtown if you have something that's more convenient and more close. And that's happening all over the city. Just look at what's happening in Regency. So I think that's why the public is kind of pretty split. Like, some can see that, yeah, it needs to go to make something better. And so it's like, well, no, it's the Landing. It's a landmark. Let's keep it. It's just about now, what are you going to do with the land once it's gone?
Linda's in Lakeshore. She has some thoughts about all of the news of the week. Hey, Linda, good morning.
Good morning. My question is, maybe a way to counteract this, and I don't know if the charter allows it, could we have a recall on the mayor and his administration, or recall vote?
You know, Linda, we're getting tweets asking that. Here's one from Paula. If there's a movement to recall any Curry, put the info out there. I want to help. Linda, thanks for the call. You know, it's my understanding that there is not a working recall mechanism for that, for this type of situation where the public could theoretically rise up and recall a public official that they're unhappy with. But correct me if I'm wrong.
There seems to be some kind of process, and I think it's like 60% of eligible votes. It's just such a high bar.
It's not realistic. One of you pointed out earlier, the mayor was reelected with 16% of the voting public in his reelect. He will hold office till 2023. And a number of controversial decisions have happened since his reelection that we're talking about today. The privatization push for JEA, the demolition of the Landing, and then the other big issue that's drawn controversy in recent months is the holdup of a proposed half-cent sales tax to repair and upgrade local school buildings around Duval County. Those three issues in particular have been divisive for this community, and the mayor has taken a good amount of heat for them. That said, as Giorgio pointed out, there isn't enough unrest among the public to mount the kind of recall push that some people have talked about. Mike.
Well, and any type of recall push is it's a pretty drastic measure. So, I mean, you want a high bar for something like that when you're talking about removing, a duly elected leader. That being said, I think that Mayor Curry felt like he had a mandate when he came in to push his vision that may not have actually existed.
Go ahead, Giorgio.
Which is bizarre because when you're elected, first of all, only 16% turnout, you get, you know, just over half of that. So roughly 8%. I mean, you need a little bit of humility going into that situation. And there was no evidence of that whatsoever.
But I think that's part of the problem. Like you said, the mayor felt like he had a mandate to come in and push his vision. But I don't think that's what it means when we elect someone as a member of the public and a member of the voting body. You are elected to push the will of the people, not your own personal vision for what you think the city wants or what you want to make it to be, or to expand your political coffers, increase your clout, and then go off into the sunset to do whatever that you want to do next. The issues that are on the table that he's been getting some of the most flack for, like the half-cent sales tax for the school board and the JEA sale and the demolition of buildings around the city without a plan to increase them, is basically like, what is the plan? Yes, you want a better Jacksonville. You want one city, one Jacksonville, one mission, everybody to be united. But you have not put forth a plan to show how what you're doing is the right way to serve the people. What are you doing to serve the people? Because the things that they want, better schools and an open process of whether or not to sell the public utility, and if it's sold, what to do with the money, how is that serving the people that you are here to serve?
And you know, there could be benefits to selling JEA, financial benefits to this community. And that is a case that you're right. It really has not yet been made.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I think the public would be open to hearing that case be made, to understanding what the benefit of this is. You might surmise that Mayor Curry sees an opportunity in his staff to provide a whole range of benefits for Jacksonville by selling off JEA without raising taxes.
And then say that and explain it.
Here is an email from Frederick. The one benefit of privatization, a possible sale to Florida Power and Light or Duke Energy, is the change that would occur with regard to net metering. He says, as a homeowner trying to reduce my carbon footprint, JEA has discouraged net metering with their revised energy buyback plan. For homeowners wanting to invest in energy independence, solar, energy saving technologies, JEA offers little in the way of incentives compared to these other utilities. The customer rebate being floated could be used to invest in these renewable technologies to the benefit of the customer, and that would last for years. Let's talk about that. And also, he mentioned a customer rebate that's being floated. Theoretically, the city could go to Duval County residents and say, along with the sale of JEA, everybody's getting a check. What about that?
Well, that is that's a huge, you know, selling point. And that's probably going to be, when there is eventually a full-fledged campaign to sell JEA, that's going to be one of the things that they're pushing. The other thing that you have to ask, too, is are the gains short-term or long-term? When you sell JEA, you're going to be losing that consistent contribution, which I believe is at $118 million per year, to the city coffers. So you're going to be losing that. And even if you pay off all of the city's debt, which will it will increase our credit rating, which is a good thing, but as a city. But it'll also, it doesn't stop future city councils and future leaders from taking out additional debt. And also, too, if you have a slowing economy, you know, even if you have a great credit rating, it still may make progress difficult, you know, in the long run.
Giorgio.
And I think the fundamental question is accountability. So if there's a problem with JEA as it exists now, it's community owned. I mean, we can fine tune it through that architecture, whereas if you sell it, becomes privatized, then you have a different accountability mechanism. And this is not like shopping for toothpaste. If you don't like what you get, you can't just go buy another one.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Andy. There is absolutely no consideration for the will of the people being shown by local officials. How long will people continue to choose bad governance in the service of supposed less governance? Okay, this gets at all of the issues we're talking about. We've talked about these issues on this program for months now. The school issue, the JEA issue, other issues, this perception that the will of the majority of Duval County voters is being thwarted on a number of critical issues that pertain to the future of this town. And so, you know, we will continue to invite all of the members of the city council to appear on this program and discuss that. We've had a number of them. We'll continue to do that. You know, when you talk to the city council, Mike, what are they saying to you about what they're hearing from their constituents?
It depends on which city council member you talk to, you know, and it depends on the political makeup of their district. It depends on you know, who they, you know, who supported them in their election financially. There's some city council members will tell you that, you know, the half cent sales tax, it's their with the school district, it's their duty to do due diligence to make sure taxpayer dollars are spent properly. Others, it's you know, we just have a duty to pass this tax to make you know, the school board do what they are elected to do.
So. And if there's enough fallout, particularly over JEA, how does that set up candidates for the next cycle, the next election cycle?
I mean, people are going to be keen to vote the bums out.
And who might be stepping up? You know, which members do you think would be vulnerable as we look at this? It's a ways off. But at the next mayoral election, too, in 2023, who runs on these issues? How is that playing field going to shake out? These are questions we can kind of theorize a little bit about because we're still 3 years out. But certainly there are people out there weighing this and this discontent. They could run on some of these issues.
It'd be a complete opposition campaign. Those who stake their political careers on, I didn't vote with the mayor. I stood for this issue. I would not have done this to you if I were mayor. I would have done it this way. They will be able to make a really good argument because I think people always like to look at the fantastical when over the realist of what they would do in a certain situation if they were in that position. And I just think that goes back to what Georgia was talking about, the 16% of the voting public turned out to reelect this mayor who thinks he came in on a mandate and a major wave to change the entire face of Jacksonville. But you're hearing the public say, nah, bruh. Nah, that's not what you're here for. And it's just, one, go vote. Two, and let your vote be your voice.
And we want your voice on this show. As you've been listening online, we are working to fix a busted transmitter here at WJCT. In the meantime, stream us at wjct.org/listen. We should be back over the air this afternoon. You can call us and talk about the top stories of the week, 549-2937, and we'll keep getting your emails and tweets on the air. I want to touch on something I mentioned a minute ago. The heat the city's taking for what could be an unsafe situation in parts of the Riverwalk. Mike, you cover downtown. Are they going to get that fixed?
Well, part of the whole vision for downtown is to expand the Riverwalk. So it's going to be a key piece of their marketing push for downtown. I know with the Ford on Bay property, which is the former Duval County Courthouse and City Hall, that Riverwalk is going to be a key access point. So the short answer is yes, they are going to fix it. Mm-hmm. Especially something with perception, they will. It'll just be, who puts forth the legislation to get it taken care of.
Right. And at the same time, that piece of Riverwalk along Liberty Street on the North Bank, years have gone by and that is still not repaired. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, and it shows the priorities. $18 million to drop the landing during an election campaign, right? So Lenny Curry was buying an endorsement at the same time as he was spending way too much for the landing, whereas you can't do some basic maintenance right down the street.
Yeah, it came up in Mayor Curry's first mayoral run. He heavily criticized Alvin Brown for not repairing that piece while Brown was mayor. And that was certainly fair criticism. Here now, though, we're looking at a situation where 5 years later, it still hasn't been repaired. And so there, I think it is fair to look at that.
It's now, like a monopoly strategy where you buy all the land and then you start to put property on it to win the game. Only the city of Jacksonville is not the game of Monopoly. Like, you've got Liberty Street, you've got the old courthouse building, you're going to eventually have the landing space. There's talk about moving the convention center from the Prime Osborne, and to get that entire strip of land along the river and then to do it all at once.
All at once.
And that's...
And Mike,
say that.
There's news about Lot J. Let's talk about that. The piece around the stadium that Shad Khan plans to develop.
Yeah, so the Downtown Investment Authority is going to be considering a short-term license for the developers to actually go in and start environmental testing. So soil boring, testing of groundwater, to kind of see what they're going to be up against when they do break ground, which is supposed to be sometime in early January. So so that is going to be the first bit of site work that we're actually going to see. With Lot J.
And so a lot of this is a lot of what we're discussing today has to do with Shad Khan's vision and the mayor's buy-in to the development of Lot J. That's that needs to be mentioned once again.
Yeah, and semi-related, in the neighborhood, Metropolitan Park just lost Welcome to Rockville. And yesterday, Daytona Beach music lovers were happy to hear that next year's headliner is Metallica. Welcome to Rockville in Daytona Beach.
It's going down there. Okay, another downtown headline we want to talk about. This is a high-rise that has really fallen by the wayside over a lot of years, but it's getting a facelift. The former Independent Life Building near the federal courthouse is being redeveloped with apartments and a fancy rooftop bar, along with a restaurant and grocery store. Let's talk about this, Mike. This is one of several projects happening in the urban core that the Downtown Investment Authority is pointing to show forward movement and really beefing up the city center and bringing young people in, bringing people in from the suburbs to spend their money, bringing vibrancy to the city.
Yeah, and this development project has what they've been seeking for quite a while now, and which is a grocery store mm-hmm. downtown in the urban core. So that's kind of it's something that the DIA officials, downtown boosters, have been chasing for a while now. I think it sends a signal that the number of residents in downtown is growing. That it's projected to continue growing. So that's something that's really it's exciting about this particular.
The magic number has always been you need 10,000 people living in a downtown area to really get the kind of critical mass that you seek to make a downtown come alive. Isn't that that's what they've been trying to get for years? What are we at now? 6,000?
Yeah, we're just right around 6,000. The chamber is projecting that we'll be right around that 10,000 number within a couple of years with all the residential units that are starting to come online. It makes sense for the Augustine Development Group to purchase this building. They also they also own the former Ambassador Hotel, which is right mm-hmm. across the street. So they're really looking at this as a way to make sure that the area that they are making a big investment in stays vibrant.
It's amazing that it's taken this long to get a rooftop bar in downtown Jacksonville. Other cities started putting those up 20 years ago, but hey. Better late than never, right?
Yeah. The big problem that downtown Jacksonville has faced is that it hasn't been priced realistically. It's been priced kind of on spec as what it's going to be like 10 years from now. But in the meantime, you have to pay way too much for how it is now. And it's slowly getting there, but I think it could have gotten there a lot quicker if rents were just a little bit more realistic.
So that's something that is an issue, not just for the urban core, but the entire community. Finding affordable rent, that we could talk about that all day. Jacksonville is not unique. That's a problem in every city. It's tough to find an affordable one-bedroom apartment anywhere in Jacksonville that's a decent place to live for most people. And that does have an impact on the urban issues we're discussing. Nikisha.
I think the issue of rent and the urban core and just... It's always going to be cheaper to own than it is to rent, no matter what city you're in, even if owning looks like it's priced out of your price point. But the problem of ownership is that if you're renting, you don't have enough money to save to try to own. So it's just a cycle that you really can't get out of. And then the places that are affordable to live in for some of our impoverished people in Jacksonville, they aren't good places to live. The Eureka Gardens and Camelot Gardens and places like that, we see those issues over and over again about they're basically like slums and people are forced to live in these horrible conditions. As to the downtown Jacksonville, the new building, I think I have no issues with that. Rooftop bar, a grocery store, that's what they've been needing this entire time, especially the grocery store. I mean, you see the rooftop bars in Riverside, you see them in San Marco, and I think there's one on top of Cowford Chop House.
Yeah, in Bay Street.
But I mean, you need more
that's
of
true.
That.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I forgot about the Cowford location. Thank you for correcting me there.
No worries, yes. But I mean, it needs more of that, and you need something back to the other things that we've been discussing. Once the people come to downtown and they move in and they live here, what are they going to do? Where are they going to go for entertainment?
One thing they get to do downtown is go to football games. I want to quickly mention that Gardner Minshew says he's excited to go against a player on the defensive side of the New Orleans Saints that he knew in his high school days in Mississippi. Let's just take a minute to talk about Minshew Mania, which has been a bright spot lately in our local news landscape. What are your thoughts about this, Mike?
Well, as somebody who's new to Jacksonville and actually went to their first Jags game a couple of weeks ago, it's pretty exciting. I mean, it's when you get a personality like that to really, you know, to gravitate around, it generates excitement, and you know, in all parts of Jacksonville, all walks of life have something that everyone can really rally behind. So that's fun.
There's an article about Minshew that ran on ESPN this morning. The headline is Florida Man 2.0. Behind the minstache, the Gardner Minshew mustache, lies genius tendencies, says ESPN. So what is it about this guy that's caught the imagination of so many fans out there, do you think?
Is that a sports thing?
I think it goes beyond sports. I think this is a cultural thing.
It's the personality.
You don't even have to like football to kind of get excited about this guy. Mm-hmm. That's a rare mm-hmm. thing.
I don't know. I'm not very excited, but
I
don't like football. So,
it's just been remarkable to me to watch the way this player has come out of nowhere, really.
Yeah.
And capture the imagination of so many people, except Giorgio. people that, you know, love football, and people that are just kind of casual fans. He just has a charisma that's been a good thing, I think, for this city.
Yeah, it's the personality, it's the campiness of it, it's his shtick or whatever. And so far, he's been having results on the football field.
And our director, Michelle Corm, says she believes it's the jorts. Not the mustache. That is the appeal of Mr. Minshew. Okay, thanks for that, Michelle. Good luck, Jags, as they take on the Saints. Okay, we have a couple of minutes left before the break. And instead of only in Florida, we want to spotlight the work and the insights of our panel and do a lightning round. Yes, stories that you might have missed from the week that you need to be aware of. Let's begin with Folio Weekly's Best of Jacks voting. Shameless plug. Please vote for WJCT in all categories. Giorgio, we're up for several awards, and we want to keep our streak alive.
There it is. Yeah, this is the last day to vote online, folioweekly.com. We've got a whole bunch of categories, and as Melissa mentioned, WJCT is in the running for many of them.
Yes, so please vote early and often. You can vote Chicago style at the Folio Weekly Awards. So vote, vote, vote for WJCT. The voting ends today, so vote us up out there. Nikisha, what caught your eye this week?
What caught my eye was a story I saw about the real-time crime cameras. It's been part of the big push to better police the city and also to keep it safe. So they're online in more areas and trying to help folks out, and we'll see if it works.
Let's hope so. Mike Mendenhall, what are you covering?
So this is a little more in the weeds, but so the Downtown Investment Authority is actually going to be kind of transitioning land rights from a corporate office structure in downtown to hotel and multifamily. So it just kind of shows that they're really trying to set the stage for more of that downtown-centric residential feel.
Excellent. Thank you all so much for being with us and working through our technical issues. Giorgio Valentino of Folio, and author Nikisha Williams. She's working on a new book, by the way, I think. And Mike Mendenhall of The Daily Record. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
Don't go away. Up next, it's Trombone Shorty. We'll have a preview of his concert at The Amp. Speaking of St. Augustine, they're getting a new distillery. That's also coming up here on First Coast Connect. Keep listening.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Our most basic instinct is to protect our families. Safety belts and properly installed child seats do that. They prevent injuries and deaths.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features resort lifestyle amenities which allow residents to remain active and vibrant. The new alternative to long-term care insurance, 901-4004. More at lifecare.brookdale.com.
The new Netflix Breaking Bad movie centers on Aaron Paul's character, Jesse Pinkman, the drug dealer who teamed up with his former science teacher to make and sell high-quality meth. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to my interviews with Aaron Paul and Breaking Bad's creator and writer, Vince Gilligan. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 here on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Ira Flatow. Is there something wrong with the amyloid plaque theory about Alzheimer's disease?
The main contribution of the pharmaceutical industry has been to spend several billion dollars proving that the amyloid hypothesis is a lot more complex and quite possibly wrong.
What we still don't know about Alzheimer's. On the next Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Elizabeth Warren goes on offense, the NBA goes on defense, and the White House declares war on the impeachment inquiry. There's been a lot of big moves in the news this week, including Simone Biles, whose big moves made gymnastics history. We'll get to it all in the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
You've seen him on HBO's Tremé. Well, now he's coming to town. Famed musician and actor Trombone Shorty will be live in concert at a performance at the Amp. I recently caught up with him to hear all about his new album.
Yeah, it was a big album that we did here in New Orleans, and we just try to capture some of the feeling that we're able to portray on the stage, which is hard to do on an album. So we recorded in this big open studio, which was an old church, and we wanted to get that sound in there.
Local favorite LPT is the opening act. And hey, we're giving away a pair of tickets right now for Trombone Shorty at the St. Augustine Amphitheater next Thursday, October 17th. Email us right now if you want to win. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Put Trombone Shorty in the subject line. Two pairs of tickets to Trombone Shorty up for grabs next Thursday night at the Amp. Speaking of St. Augustine, finally this hour, a brand new distillery is opening its doors in the nation's oldest city. Will Hensler is general manager and Philip McDaniel is co-founder of the new City Gate Spirits. Hey guys, good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
All right, Philip, let's start with you. You, of course, are behind the St. Augustine Distillery. Now you're busting out with something brand new. Tell us about City Gate Spirits.
Yeah, we saw an opportunity to bring a new business to downtown and appeal to a whole segment of people who don't make it over to the distillery and the ice plant, and we're really excited about it.
What will people see, Will, when they come out to City Gate Spirits? What are you featuring?
Well, as far as spirits, we're featuring three different varieties of rum. We have St. Augustine's first legally distilled moonshine with our apple pie moonshine, which we're very, very excited about.
And legally distilled moonshine?
Yes, ma'am.
Tell us more about that.
So our moonshine's made with 100% corn liquor. It's a whiskey that never gets aged. Instead, we take it and incorporate our all-natural ingredients and to come away with a really, really wonderful spirit that's just delicious over ice.
Wow. Now, this is going to be located on the north end of St. George Street. It's named after the iconic city gate there in St. Augustine. So you're really hearkening back, you know, to the founding of the city. You couldn't have a better location.
No, and it's directly across the street from the Castillo and the fort. So you can kind of see it from both sides.
What is it about craft distillery making and the whole vibe around that that's taken off so much, do you think, and it's captured the public's imagination?
I think it's the handmade nature of it. It's the artisanal nature, very much like craft beer, right? You're going to get different flavors, different spirits. And I think today more than ever, Melissa, people want to support things that are made locally. They want to know the people behind them. They want to know the story. And that's why I think they're taking off.
You've also been working pretty hard, I know, with state lawmakers to make it easier for people to buy your products when they visit you. Tell me about the update on that.
So next week, curiously, I'll be in Tallahassee testifying in the House Subcommittee on Business and Professions about some of the challenges that are currently facing craft distillers, and hopefully the legislators will listen. So we're going back at it this year.
Because currently when they visit, say, the St. Augustine Distillery, it's my understanding they can only take a couple of bottles away.
Yeah, we're limited to 6 bottles a year per person, which is kind of unthinkable in this day and age. We cannot ship the product, which is frustrating to our guests, and we can't sell a glass, which we would love to. So
you want to make all of those changes.
Correct.
So, Will, when people come out to the grand opening, what are they going to experience? This is happening tomorrow, an all-day event.
That's correct. Yeah, we're really excited about our grand opening tomorrow. The first 50 customers in the building are going to get a mystery gift card anywhere from $5 to $100. We're going to have music, prizes, games all day long, and, of course, free tastings of our handmade spirits.
Free tastings. How can you say no?
Yeah, you can't go wrong.
That's right. Now, let's explain again. This is City Gate Spirits, Northeast Florida's newest craft distillery. They're hosting their grand opening celebration tomorrow all day in St. Augustine at the north end of St. George Street, right across the street from the iconic Castillo de San Marcos. This is exciting news, and there will be some prizes and raffles handing out at the event as well. So come on out and enjoy it. And thanks, guys, for stopping by. And you brought some goodies, too, I think.
We absolutely
which we will not be drinking this morning, but maybe tonight. Will Hensler is general manager, and Philip McDaniel is co-founder of the brand new City Gate Spirits in historic St. Augustine. Go check them out. Thanks, guys, and have fun with it.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Here's a little more Trombone Shorty for you as we close out the show. Again, if you want a pair of free tickets to next Thursday night's concert at the Amp, email us right now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We're giving away 2 pairs. That's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corm directs the show. Jessica Palumbo is our station news director. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8, and we should be back up over the air by this evening. Thanks for your patience throughout our technical repairs. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.